Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist, here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddos' needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I look forward to talking with you today, talking about building confidence and independence, which is incredibly important for all of our kiddos. But our lens today is talking about how do we prepare autistic teens for college success. So welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And this is a topic that I'm very passionate about. So looking forward to the conversation.
Yes, I love that. And I just got off a call and the individual that was speaking said to what motivates you, what is your why? And so that goes along with your passion. And I think having a passion really shines through in what we do as professionals to help guide parents and other professionals. So if you want to take a second and introduce yourself, kind of why you're a special ed strategist and how you help families.
Absolutely. So I'm Beth Felsen, and I am the founder and head coach of Spectrum Transition Coaching. And Spectrum Transition Coaching is a mouthful and a tongue twister. And the goal of the business is to work one-on-one with autistic young adults and also a little bit with their families to help them with the transition out of high school. And also I do work with some young adults who are finishing college or have decided that college is not the right path and they're trying to figure out their adulting goals. So we work on that as well. I have been working in this field for, gosh, almost 25 years. My first experiences with the autism community were as a parent. One of my children, I have three children who are all in their 20s, and one of my children is on the spectrum, was diagnosed at age 4, and that has been quite a journey. It's still a journey. So when that child was in college, we realized that although we thought we were really well prepared, there were things that we didn't know, and there were obstacles. And in addition to the fact that there were obstacles, one of the obstacles actually was finding practitioners to work with young adults. My child was diagnosed right around the time when Asperger's was sort of becoming a thing. And so to tell you how long ago that was, it's no longer a thing, right? We don't talk about Asperger's anymore. But, you know, we had the benefit of some great supports in K through 12 and just really had no clear understanding of how things were going to change. So when we were looking for practitioners, the world hadn't caught up with older kids and young adults who were on the spectrum and had successful K through 12 experiences. So I had kind of this light bulb moment of, I understand the population, at least from a personal perspective, and I see that there's a need, and I think I could fill a void here. So once I made the decision to do that, then I started collecting training and all kinds of things, because being a parent is a wonderful thing, gives us lots of experiences, but really doesn't qualify me to work with this population. So I have a graduate certificate in autism spectrum disorder from George Mason. I have executive function coaching training, autism coaching training, social skills training, you name it. I just collect trainings. Anything that I feel could really help me work with this population. So that's how I got to where I am right now.
Well, let's go ahead and jump right in, right? So what are the most common challenges that autistic teens face during this college transition period? Because we talk about a lot on this show and what I do with families of kind of what can we do when they're little throughout K through 12 experience, so to say, to build their capacity to the goal of transitioning and even just the essence of an IEP, right? An individualized education program, really thinking, I always encourage families and parents to think about, where do you see your kid in 6 months, a year, right, 5 years? So you can take this forward thinking document and start to add these elements. But I think having this conversation with you is equally as important because it's going to generate some thoughts or ideas that maybe somebody hasn't thought about in terms of what can we put in the IEP? What can we be, or not in the IEP, but what could we be doing as a parent or a professional to help with this transition? I think my original question was a very long way to say that. What are some common challenges with this?
Right. So I just want to say up front, the transition to college is challenging for everyone. Whether you're neurodivergent or neurotypical, it can be a challenging transition. The difference for autistic young adults is that in the area specifically of social communication, and oftentimes a lot with executive function, there are additional challenges that are more difficult for autistic students to overcome. You know, and some people might say, well, you know, social communication skills, you know, they're going to college to learn, to be students. So why is that important? Well, it's important because only a small portion of what you spend your time doing in college is actually spent in the classroom or studying. And especially for students who go away to college, the non-academic pieces are all more accessible to them when they feel more comfortable in social situations. You hit the reset button when you go to college, mainly. You know, you may have been with the same classmates from kindergarten all the way up through high school. You may have belonged to a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout troop and been with those kids for many years. When you go to college, you are starting all over again in the social realm and approaching people, making social connections, really being able to read the body language and the social cues to determine whether or not somebody is interested in pursuing a friendship with you. If you don't have those social connections, college can be a very, very lonely place. And when we're lonely, it permeates everything. You know, so you may have a young adult who's been a superstar in the classroom. They've been very well supported. They've had all of their accommodations in place and they're used to that. And when they get to college, they're just, you know, their head's in a different place. And if they are lonely, it's going to make it even more challenging for them to succeed in the classroom. And with executive function challenges, I mean, that's pretty straightforward, right? If that's a difficult thing for you, it's going to continue to be a difficult thing when you get to college. The difference is that in K through 12, with all the supports in place, oftentimes students are very well supported for their executive function needs, and they don't have to do much to access those accommodations. They're sort of automatically in place for them in K through 12 education, in large part because of the way the law and IEPs work. You know, the teacher's going to come to you and say, you get extra time on this test, here's how that's going to work. The script gets flipped in college, which is something that a lot of parents don't understand. So if the student is not really understanding what their executive function challenges are, or they're not doing a good job of accessing their accommodations, that's going to become even more pronounced. Those challenges are going to become even more pronounced in college. And then the last piece to put those two together, the seat of executive function, right, is in the prefrontal cortex, which is the last to develop. It's also very influenced by emotion. So if you're unhappy, if you're lonely, if you're feeling anxious, and you have executive function challenges, your executive function challenges are going to be made more pronounced by those emotions. So that's a really important connection to make when we talk about the fact that the social challenges of the transition can be really difficult for autistic kids because it does permeate.
So as a parent, what can we do to support that social emotional component in high school or at younger ages to slowly start building that capacity so that when this transition occurs, and we're specifically talking about college transition, but really I think one could say that it's really any kind of life transition,
yes,
moving out of this predictable K through 12 schedule into whether it's a collegiate setting or a workforce or a skill-based training.
Yeah. Right. So college readiness skills are life skills. You know, it's just, it's a smaller microcosm of life when you go to college. So it's very interesting. The social component in K through 12, you know, when our kids are younger, we set up play dates for them. They have classmates in school. Maybe the school even has a policy that everyone in the class has to be invited to the birthday parties. You know, there's more adult input into what friendships look like in the K through 12 world, more so in the younger grades. But as I said earlier, your child may have been with the same people for a long time, and they may have no problem interacting with them at school, you know, participating in extracurriculars. But parents have to really understand the difference between a true friendship and an acquaintanceship. And a lot of parents, myself included, when my autistic child was younger, think that they're the same thing, right? So we see our child comfortable in their Boy Scout or Girl Scout troop, in the band, in whatever extracurriculars they're involved in. We see them participating in group projects and activities in the classroom, and they're getting along fine with their peers. And we say to ourselves, my child has friends, my child has no trouble making friends. But that may not really be the case. For autistic young adults, finding good sources of friends, acknowledging to someone else that you want to try and build a friendship with them, and then maintaining and deepening friendships are not intuitive skill sets. And I would say that one thing that parents could do is to help their young adult become educated in that area, understanding the difference between an acquaintance and a true friend. And there are a couple of differences, but the biggest difference is a true friend is going to want to go the extra mile to spend time with you outside of the settings where you're thrown together by the nature of the beast. So, you know, if the child in your child's class invites them to do something on the weekend, nobody calls anymore, right? But texts them and says, you know, would you like to come hang out with me, or whatever kids do these days? That's going the extra mile, right? So that's different than chatting with the person who sits next to you in the band room. It takes time, lots of time, to build those skills, but understanding how to find good sources of friends and begin friendships is critical. And if parents can help their young adults do that before they get to college, when there are all kinds of other stressors and it's going to make everything else more difficult, that's a gift that you can give to your children.
Let me ask you, because this question has come up in the podcast previously, what are your thoughts in the community that you work with, the families that you support, on when you talk about good sources of friends and friendships, about students or individuals doing online gaming where they're communicating with each other in that capacity that may not be in the traditional sense of meeting somebody in their school day, but having these friendships that are formed on an online platform?
That's a great question. I believe that the nature of friendship and social relationships has definitely evolved since, you know, I was in elementary school. And a lot of young adults spend time gaming online. You know, they have these Discord server groups that they participate in. And that's a social connection. That is absolutely a social connection. And the young adults derive a lot of satisfaction from those connections. And they're important, but it's also important to feel comfortable in in-person settings. One of the things that you, I believe one of the pieces of the question you asked me previously is what parents can do, you know, with the transition to college in addition. And one of the best ways to find good sources of friends is to involve yourself in activities and go to places where you can meet people who have common interests. So one of the things about the online stuff is, you know, if everybody's playing the same game, you know, that's a common interest. And that helps, that gives them things to talk about, and it can be very satisfying. Those people might be more of acquaintances than real true friends. In college and even in high school, joining in activities that are things that interest you, you know, finding a club. One of the things that I do with the students that I work with to help them with the transition is we look at the website for the college that they're going to be attending or the colleges that they're considering. And we look at the clubs and organizations that are available to them. And I ask students to pick a few that they're interested in learning more about. And going to college knowing there's already a D&D group that you can join, and then working to put yourself out there and go to those meetings, those are good sources of friends. Any common activity is a good source of friends.
Thinking about self-advocacy, how can we as parents effectively teach our young adults or teens the ability to express their needs or seek accommodations? Because we kind of hit on this in terms of how the law shifts in special education support for our kids that are transitioning to college. That right. Support looks very different. How do we combine these skills when we're growing our babies in terms of expressing their needs, their wants, and then also being able to seek those accommodations while they're still in school with that layered support, and then growing that capacity so that they'll have that when they get out into the world?
Right. We could have a whole podcast about self-advocacy, right? There's lots of different components. I think there are two very basic things that parents can do from very early on. One is to normalize and remove the shame from a diagnosis. It's much easier to advocate for yourself and what you need based on your disability profile if you're not ashamed of that label or, you know, whatever it is. So that's one thing. Another thing is for our young adults to really understand their diagnoses and their needs. I meet with families all the time who tell me that their child is not aware of what their actual diagnoses are, that they know they have an IEP, they know that certain things are difficult for them, but they don't have the labels. And, you know, it doesn't change who the person is, right? The label, but understanding more about your disability, what that profile looks like, how it impacts you individually, and why the accommodations are in place, what they help you with, is, I think, a foundational notion when it comes to the concept of self-advocacy. So those are two key components. The other thing is modeling, right? Our kids take their lead from us all the time. So if we want them to be able to, for example, one of the things they have to do, you know, if you have kids under 18 and you've not gotten to this point yet, your kids are going to have to make their own doctor's appointments and refill their own prescriptions and, you know, all that kind of stuff. If we want them to be able to do that, modeling it for them is really the best thing. So, you know, that's a gradual process. Have them get on the phone with you or put it on speakerphone when you're scheduling an appointment so they hear what that transaction sounds like. Practice it. you know, those kinds of things, really giving them an opportunity to try out some of these self-advocacy skills and get better at them and build their confidence in doing those things is a great thing. And then the other place that it's sort of baked into who our kids are is the IEP process, making sure that your child is participating in the IEP process. And when they're too young, you know, at some point the law says they should be participating, or they, you know, they, I don't know if it's a mandatory thing, but, you know, even when they're too young to really sit at the table, literally, you can have a conversation with them about, you know, mommy and daddy are going in to meet with your teachers to talk about how things are going in class. What are your thoughts? Third grader, you know, how are things going? Do you feel like you're getting the support that you need? And teaching them that language and making them, again, confidence, you know, building that confidence in expressing their opinion and sharing their ideas and then being taken seriously, I think really could go a long way to building those self-advocacy skills from a very young age.
And to add to that, I also like to ask the kiddos kind of more open-ended question, like what does support look like for you? Mm-hmm. What, you know, kind of what do you like about that? What don't you like about that? If you, you know, I always talk about parents prioritizing, but also with kids. And as they get older, they certainly can do this. You know, if you had to prioritize X, Y, and Z with support, what do you think works best? So that you right. have that focus of that IEP when you're going to that meeting for that student and with that student. And then you can also help guide them to, you know, do you have questions for a team that is not open-ended, as I just suggested, but be able to take the conversation that you're having and organically come up with some questions that they can then ask, because that then helps lead that modeling and that ability to advocate and teaching them those skills.
Absolutely. And one other thing, part of self-advocacy is feeling comfortable speaking up and asking for what you need, right? So a lot of my clients feel like their accommodations are giving them an advantage. And so when they get to college and they have more control over using those accommodations or, you know, asking for the extra time, they hesitate to do it because they don't want to get a leg up on the competition, so to speak. So, you know, you and I are both wearing glasses, right? So I always, when I meet a young adult who has that attitude, I remind them that accommodations level the playing field. That's all it does. If I take my glasses off, let's see what happens. Well, I can see you kind of clearly, but I can't read anything that's on my screen. So, you know, putting on my glasses just gives me the same ability to function as someone who doesn't need glasses. Again, you know, that stigma of, oh, accommodations are a bad thing, or I shouldn't need them, or, you know, helping our young adults to realize that that's not the case.
I'd like to take some time and talk about life skills, mm-hmm. right? So things like managing finances, self-care, really all play into that independence.
Yep.
What are some activities or strategies that you use with either your teens or young adults to help them gain these skills, or guidance that you share with parents to help them start to embed some of this in their daily routine?
Great question. So one of the things that I want to point out is, you know, think about how you feel when those aspects of your life are not well managed, right? When you have no idea what the balance is in your checking account, or, you know, have I charged too much on my card, or is there food in my refrigerator so that I can make dinner tonight? It's a source of stress when we don't have control over those things. And stress in general, it's not good for anybody to feel stress. But again, going back to that, you know, how can I maximize my executive function skills and all of that? The more stress you have, the less likely you're going to be able to manage, you know, your time and get your assignments done and, you know, all that other kind of stuff. So being good at life skills is important as a stress reduction technique. So I always like to start there, but there are lots of things that parents can do. When my kids were little, we to explain to them the concept of taxes. Okay. Anytime they had dessert, we would take our taxes. So, you know, you get a big chocolate chip cookie and it's like, oh, I need my taxes. And I'd break off a little piece and that would be for me. And that was a great way for us to explain to them. You're like, well, why are you doing that? And, you know, and it was kind of as a little bit of a joke, but it helped us to talk to them about the concept of, you know, you get money, but it doesn't actually all belong to you. You have to set aside a piece to pay your taxes or, you know, for whatever your expenses are. So even silly little things like that when our kids are really little can help them with those lessons. The greatest way to do it is to give them more responsibility in a supportive environment. So one of the greatest challenges that some of my students have when they get to college is they have no idea how to do their own laundry. Okay. So when they're, you know, old enough to work the washing machine or strong enough to carry their laundry basket down to wherever the washer is, you know, whenever you feel they're ready, you can involve them in the laundry and so that it normalizes their participation in that. And then at some point, turn it over to them. You know, you're now responsible for your own laundry. And what that does is it teaches them about consequences, the consequences of their own actions. You know, I remember when my kids were in high school, they all participated in chorus. And there was the chorus t-shirt, you know, had to be clean on a certain day. And, you know, it became their responsibility. You know, if you know that you need your t-shirt for Friday and today is Thursday and it's in the dirty laundry, guess what? It's you either have to pull it out of the dirty laundry or you have to do your wash. And the whole idea of understanding what the consequences are of either doing the thing or not doing the thing is a part of that learning process. When it comes to the kitchen and food, nutrition, and cooking, cook with your kids. Teach them how to make certain dishes. Make sure they know how to cut an onion. I mean, you know, things like that you can do you start with the modeling. You know, I need you to be my sous chef tonight in the kitchen. Here's what we need for this recipe. You know, can you find all these things in the pantry and the refrigerator and start that way so that by the time their fine motor skills and their, you know, they can manage more, give them more responsibility. Using an allowance to teach money management, you know, that can be important as well. Self-care can be challenging in the autistic community between sensory sensitivities and sort of like a lack of awareness of how what you do impacts other people around you. The focus on self-care is not always where we want it to be. And so what I suggest is problem solving, working with your young adult. If they say, you know, I hate washing my hair because I don't like the, you know, the feeling of my fingers on my scalp, try and problem solve that and see if you can figure out a way for them to wash their hair without touching their scalp. Or, you know, meet them where they are and then build from there. Have a conversation about, you know, I talk about walking through, it's a rarity at this point, but I used to talk about walking through the cosmetics area of the department store and all of the scents that kind of come at you and how it can be uncomfortable. Well, when we don't shower, you know, if we have body odor, we may not care. We may be used to the way we smell, but when we're around other people, that may become really uncomfortable. Just pointing that out in a, you know, not in a shameful way, but, you know, just matter-of-factly can be really helpful. You know, oh, I didn't think about that. I didn't realize that. And then coming up with a compromise of, you know, how often do I really need to shower? So that by the time our kids are, you know, adults, they kind of have a routine already with those things. One of the last thing I want to talk about with life skills, and this is a time management issue also, and we're all guilty of this, is waking our kids up in the morning and making sure that they're out of bed and they're dressed and they've had breakfast before the school bus comes or before they have to leave for school. And I did it I'm sure you do it, Wendy. You know, everybody does it. But, you know, one of the important things to remember is that the parent's not going to be able to have that same ability when the student's in college. And so working on that life skill of being able to get up in the morning independently and get ready is a big one. It's a really big one.
Phenomenal tips. As you were speaking, I was thinking kind of that concept of seeing the forest through the trees, right? And so as a parent, I have three boys, all so different. They couldn't be any more different with how they approach life and learning and all of those fun things. I find that with life, and even the parents that I work with and support get so busy, right? So, but I love the concept of prioritizing what is going on now, and then how do we break down those steps? How do we problem solve those steps? So what advice do you give parents to kind of be able to slow down the moment and really kind of think through a couple of things of what you want next that you would think would be the next step in teaching independence and autonomy with our kiddos to then be able to kind of see the trees through the forest?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So I, two things. One is you got to pick your battles, right? Actually, three things. You have to pick your battles. So, you know, pick the things that, you know, as a busy parent, what is going to make your life easier? You know, boy, oh boy, did it make my life easier when my kids were all doing their own laundry and I only had to worry about mine and my husband's. I mean, that was huge, right? So think about places where it could help the family function more smoothly if your child had more responsibility in that area. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to ask your child, you know, to tell them, we would like for you to have more responsibility. That's an important thing, you know, as you're growing into adulthood, it's really important for you to have some responsibility. Here are five areas where we're thinking that we could turn over some responsibility to you. And, you know, slowly with scaffolding that you slowly pull away, pick two. You know, or, you know, give your child some agency over where, you know, it's non-negotiable that they're going to take on more responsibility, but give them some agency over deciding where to start, you know, and explaining to them that the goal is ultimately that you're going to be doing all these five things, but we're asking you to choose where you want to begin. So that's part one. Part two is it really takes some homework on the part of the parents. Because we have to, as our kids get older, we have to shift our communication style and the way we parent. When our kids are very young, especially for families where there are children who have support needs, and you know, we're mama bears, right? Mama bears and papa bears. We're advocating for our kids all over the place. We're managing their lives out of necessity when they're very young. And then it kind of becomes a habit. And quite frankly, it's sometimes easier to just do it ourselves than to make it take twice as long because they're helping us with it or we're asking them to do it. But as our kids get older, we have to shift into a more advisory role as parents. And that's important for a couple of reasons. One is we want our children to develop really good decision-making and problem-solving skills. If they know that they can problem-solve, then that makes them more confident and it builds resilience, right? So confidence and resilience are critical adulting skills. And if we're giving them the answers or we're pushing our, you know, what you should do is this, then they're not developing their problem-solving skills. Now, I'm not saying that shifting to this advisory role is easy because it sure as heck is not. But if we can take a step back and say to our child, okay, here's the, you've identified a problem. What do you think you should do? And if they say, I don't know, you know, you say, well, let's brainstorm. Let's just brainstorm together. And then have them decide, okay, this is the approach I want to take. If you don't think it's the best approach, you can ask questions like, well, if you do it that way, what'll happen if, you know, but you're giving them the agency. You're putting them in the driver's seat with your support. And so those two things together are critical, you know, picking the areas where you want to focus and then working on this shift of parenting styles is, I totally forgot what your original question was, Wendy, but I think I'm answering it.
Totally. And as you're giving all this terrific nuggets of information, kind of goes to that kind of seeing the big picture, little picture. That's what we call it in our house. And what I do when I support families is, you know, what is the big picture here, whether it's a one task or future goal. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what is the little picture, right? So if the big picture is, say, teaching organization skills and time management and study skills, thinking of kind of our school age students, then maybe right now the bigger picture is not the end result of the grades, but it's moving towards that. Yes. And I do like what you said about, you know, here are five areas. I want you to pick two. I feel like the power of choice gives the student the sense of control and the sense of buy-in, right? Mm-hmm. So we call that assuming the sale. So we know that you're going to learn all five of these, but right now I'm just giving you the choice, right? So we know you're going to go to bed. You can either go to bed now or in 10 minutes, like assuming the sale in that conversation so that there is some buy-in which has power for an individual. And I do want to add, in terms of kind of teaching that independence, thinking about, you had mentioned medication, but having a student, when it's appropriate, understand what medications they're taking.
Yes.
The names of the medication, whether it's the full name or the generic name. Mm-hmm. And then understanding what that medication does. And also even having the conversation of when you're in college or the real world and you're consuming this medication, and if you are faced with, whether it's, you know, drugs or alcohol or whatever that may be, you can now understand what this is going to do to your body, so you have a more informed choice. I think that's incredibly important for individuals. There's a lot of kids that don't know. They know they take meds, they have no idea the name, when to take them, the dosage, and why. I think the why is right. important to have that conversation, especially as we have young adults moving out, and then coming up with ways that they can be independent and taking those medications, whether it's, we call it the wheel of independence, where it like rotates right. on a time and it lights up. There's ones that attach to your app, whatever it may be, so that they can start to take the medications at the time they're supposed to. Obviously scaffolding, obviously all the parental warnings that go along with that. You know your kid best, but just in the thinking through that, if my child is going to be living independently, whether that's in a dorm or in a life setting,
right,
they're going to need to be understanding the when, the where, the why, and then also kind of, oh, my prescription is running out, which is a really big executive function skill, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Folks can't see you nodding and smiling, but it's so true. And not just being like, oh my gosh, my pill just ran out. I need to call the pharmacist, and even how to do that and how to get a fill, but not do it the day of or when you're right. already out, kind of
right.
thing. Executive right. function moving forward.
Exactly. You know, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, the beauty of doing these things, thinking about these things, starting to work on these things when our kids are younger, is the methodology is going to look different for everybody. You know, mm-hmm. some people like a paper calendar, some people like an online calendar, some people like, you know, a med case that's electronic, and some people don't. So it gives you the luxury of time to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And a lot of this is trial and error, you know, to get to the point where your young adult has a system in place for whatever it is that works for them. And part of that shift from manager to advisor parenting is, I hear a lot of parents say, you know, I want my child to use a paper calendar because I find that it's the best way, blah, 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 blah. Well, it may be the best way for you, but it may not be the best way for your child. And coming to that understanding that as long as the sausage gets made, you know, we don't really care what the process is. And that's, you know, also what you're talking about, the big picture and the little picture. It's really important to figure out what works for our kids and what they can form good habits around and what they can do consistently. So that, because the building of the confidence and the resilience is not only for our young adults, but it's also for us, right? So that when we send them off to college, we know that they can be successful. We know that they know how to do these things, because that's a scary thing to send a child off to college and not to see them every day and not be able to check in with them and see what their face looks like when they walk in the door after school. You know, that was my biggest fear when my oldest went to college, is I'm not going to be able to read them when they get home and see what kind of day they had without asking a single question.
I would be remiss, or we would be remiss, because we're talking about building that confidence, that independence, and preparing our autistic students for college success. How does a family or an individual go about seeking colleges that can support those neurodiversities? And there's many programs that have kind of more of a Daniels, that has the Ames program and just kind of different built-in supports. But what advice do you give parents and preteens, or teens, I should say, or young adults, in seeking that, to find the balance between what the individual support that they need or require versus still growing that autonomy and independence?
Right. So there's a couple of things. First of all, by the time you're looking at colleges, or I should say by the time you're applying to colleges, you should have a good idea of the supports that your young adult really cannot do without. A lot of times there are supports that our kids receive in school that really could be faded, or at least partially faded, by the time they're ready to graduate. So having an understanding of what the true need is. My child definitely needs extended time on tests, or my child definitely needs to meet with an executive function coach 3 times a week in order to stay organized, you know, whatever that is. Understand what the needs are and use that as your starting point when you're looking at schools. Every college has they call it something different at different places, but they have a disability services office. So even if your child is not in, you know, a special support program, they can get some of the supports that they need. Educate yourself about the law and what accommodations look like. So we've mentioned law a couple of times, and I'm sure you've done podcasts about this before, but just to say out loud, the difference between the IDEA, which is the law that governs K through 12, and then once our students graduate from high school, they then fall under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. So the metric is different. It's instead of free and appropriate education and providing anything that the student needs, it's reasonable accommodations. And the schools get to decide what reasonable accommodations are. There are very common things, like extra time on tests or quiet testing space, you know, that kind of stuff. And so every college is going to be able, if your student qualifies for services, and I'll talk about that in just a second, but if your student qualifies, any college is going to be able to provide those basic supports. Where we get into, does my child need a special support program, is when they have needs that go above and beyond what the standard accommodations are, right? So if your child in the autistic community, okay, so if you really want to make sure that your child is getting social interaction, there are more and more schools every day that have special support programs that include a social component. I work with a student who's at Bridgewater. It's Bridgewater College. They have a program called BACE, and part of what they do in the BACE program is they have social activities and events that the students in that program participate in. That's like an accommodation or a support need that goes above and beyond what you can get through the regular disability services office. So that's one thing to think about, is what does my child need, and will they be able to get that at any one given school? When you're thinking about that stuff, you should call the disability services office. Any school that's on your list that you're thinking about attending, make a phone call. You don't have to say who you are. You don't have to identify, you know, who your child is, but you can say, my child, or better yet, for self-advocacy purposes, do this with your child. Have your child actually make the phone call or be on speakerphone together. And, you know, you're asking questions about, you know, how many students does your disability services center support? What's the staff to student ratio? You know, will my student be able to get this accommodation and be able to, you know, meet with somebody if they need to? What's your process? Right. So it used to be that every school required that you have an evaluation, a psychoeducational evaluation that was 3 years old or younger. So, you know, within the last 3 years that you have a psychoeducational evaluation, which can be a huge expense. A lot of schools now are saying, you know, just send us whatever paperwork you have. If you currently have an IEP, send us what you have. Send us a letter from, you know, one of your support professionals that outlines what your disability accommodation needs are. Find out what the process is so that you know whether that's something that you can do. And then always, always, always visit and ask to speak with students. If you're looking at a school that has a specific support program like McDaniel or like Bridgewater or George Mason or, you know, any number of schools, ask if you can speak with a current student. That can be huge. And parent to parent also, you know, as a parent of a student, ask if you can be put in touch with a family. That's going to look different at every school, but, you know, it's in the college's best interest to provide you with as much information as you know, as they can so that you can make an informed decision about whether or not this is a good fit for your child. Did I answer the question?
Yes, 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 yes. And so our oldest is in his second year of college. And when we were doing the tours, I said, look around and see if people are smiling. That was my one tip. Yeah. One tip. We had lots of tips, but that was like the one. And then we went to a couple of visits and he's like, Mom, you know what? I didn't see a lot of smiles. And I was like, how does that make you feel? Are you interested? And he's like, and yeah. Even one school was like torrential downpour and we're doing the tour, but people were laughing and smiling. He's like, even with terrible weather, people are smiling. He ended up not choosing that particular school, but I think that's just kind of thinking of things that way of such a big transition. Anyways, as we kind of narrow down our conversation, what is one thing that I did not ask, I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked during our podcast today?
I would say the myriad differences between the K-12, mainly high school environment, and what the college environment looks like, and how those differences relate to the skill sets that are important for a smooth transition. That is something that people don't think about too much. One of the biggest differences is the amount of time that students spend in the classroom and the structure of the day. So in college, you're only in class a few hours a week, and it's up to you to decide when you're going to work on, you know, doing the reading for your classes and getting your work done. So time management and building those executive function skills. The executive function muscle is something that our kids may not be flexing as much or in the same way in K-12 as they will need to in college. And so that's where the idea of looking at the supports they're receiving and figuring out how to fade them a little bit, how to take a step back so that they can get better at doing it themselves can be really important. Another critical difference between high school and college is the way instruction happens. In K-12, for the most part, you're learning the material in class with the teacher, and then the stuff that you do at home is really practicing to make sure that you understand it. In college, that again, oftentimes will flip so that the students are learning the material through the work that they're doing outside the classroom. And then when they get into the classroom, they're synthesizing that material. They're taking that material a step further. So for example, if your child, you know, if completing assignments, reading assignments is challenging for your young adult, that's something that you're going to want to look at in terms of the pace of the work that needs to happen outside of the classroom. So that's something that I think it falls under that I don't know what I don't know kind of category, mm-hmm. which is a big part of why the college transition can be challenging is because people just don't know what they don't know.
Which is a beautiful segue into my question of, you have a course about this. Give us just a little snapshot so that folks know that they do know, and so that that will help guide them of what things that they may not know.
Yes. So after the years that I've been spending working with this population and seeing, you know, how the transition goes, parents are ready to talk about and think about these topics typically much earlier than their young adults are. And so what I've done is created this course for parents that provides them with the foundational knowledge and the skill building tools that they'll need to be able to begin to work with their young adults on college readiness, which we also know is really life readiness, independence readiness, while their students are at home in the very supportive environment that they're providing. So we cover some foundational concepts relating to autism and, you know, a better understanding of what autism is and what it means to be a spectrum. We talk about goal setting and what that's all about and why it's important. I go through my six areas of college readiness that I think are critical for success. And parents have an opportunity to learn what those are, assess their young adults informally, and then make decisions about places where they think they may need to begin with skill building. And then at the end of the course, I help you put all the pieces together and come up with a plan of action. There's a workbook. You get to see my face on some videos. There are lots of downloads and links and things to really provide parents with the information so that they're not in the I don't know what I don't know place. And so that once their kids are seniors in high school and really preparing for that transition, they've been able to do a lot of this work and they know where their kids still have some holes that need to be filled.
Amazing. Final question, if you had a billboard for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
I thought about this a lot because I knew you were going to ask me this question. And I will say, don't be afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to ask questions. You are never the only person who doesn't know a thing. And those of us who are on the other side of this transition want to help. And one of the reasons why I do what I do is because I want to help families avoid some of the missteps that my family took and for kids to have the success that they deserve in college and to have that full college experience. So don't be afraid to ask.
So true. So true. Well, this was such a pleasure. I know families that are hearing and listening to this podcast are going to get a ton of information, no matter the age or stage that their kiddo is in. And I think a lot of the tips that you shared can really go across many populations. So I appreciate your time and chatting with me today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.